The U.S. personal savings rate has hovered around 5% over the past 4 years, up from a low of less than 2% in 2007, but down from the pre-1980 days when Americans saved well over 10%. Making matters worse are stagnating wages for the vast majority of Americans, while those on top, and the corporations they work for, continue lining their pockets. Wealth is siphoning from individuals at the bottom. In a 2016 report, the Economic Policy Institute discovered that wages for the lowest 70% of workers had grown a marginal 5.3% since 2000, while the poorest 10% of Americans saw only 2.2% improvement in pay. How did the highest wage earners fare over that time period? Since the turn of the millennium, the 90th and 95th percentile of wage earners experienced 15.7% and 19.8% growth, respectively. With relatively lower wages and less savings, our level of debt has gone up, way up. By late 2017, consumer debt had topped $3.7 trillion, more than double the total at the end of 2000. That's more than $11,000 for every man, woman, and child in the country. Debt is one of our main shackles. Our levels of debt and our lack of savings make the 9-to-5 routine mandatory. Between our mortgages, car financing, student loans, and credit card debt, we can't afford to quit. More and more Americans are ending up living in their cars or on the streets. In a time of increasing globalism and corporate mergers, layoffs in every sector from manufacturing to high tech are the new reality. We are making a dying at work so we can live it up on the weekend. Consider now the average consumer spending his or her hard-earned money. Saturday, take your clothes to the cleaners and your car to the service station to have the tires rotated and the funny noise checked out. Go to the grocery store to buy a week's worth of food for the family and grumble at the checkout that you remember when 4 sacks of groceries used to cost $75 instead of $125. Sure, you could cut some costs by clipping coupons and shopping sales, but who has time? Go to the mall to buy the book that everyone is reading. Emerge with 2 books, a suit, half-price sale, with shoes to match, and some new clothes for the kids, all paid for with a credit card. Home, yard work, oops, a trip to the nursery for pruning shears. Come home with 2 flats of primroses, some new pots, oh, and yes, the pruning shears. Fiddle with a toaster that's burning every slice, even on the lightest setting. Fail to find the warranty. Go to a home improvement store to buy a new one. Come out with shelves and brackets for the den, color samples for painting the kitchen, and, oh yes, the toaster. Dinner out with your partner, leaving the kids with a sitter. Sunday morning, pancakes for the whole family. Oops, no flour. To the grocery store for flour. Come home with frozen strawberries and blueberries for the pancakes, maple syrup, Sumatra coffee, and oh yes, the flour. Take the family to the lake for a swim, buy gas, wince at the price. Drive to a cute restaurant in the country, paying for dinner with a credit card. Home. Spend the evening watching TV, allowing the ads to float you on fantasies of the really good life available if you'd only buy a Porsche or an exotic vacation or a new computer or... The bottom line is that we think we work to pay the bills, but we spend more than we make on more than we need, which sends us back to work to get the money to spend to get more stuff. That sends us back to work again. What about happiness? If the daily grind were making us happy, the irritations would be a small price to pay. If we could believe that our jobs were actually making the world a better place, we would sacrifice sleep and our social lives without feeling deprived. If the extra toys we buy with our toil were providing anything more than momentary pleasure and a chance to one-up others, we'd spend those hours on the job gladly. But it's becoming increasingly clear, beyond a certain minimum of comfort, Money is not buying us the happiness we seek. Participants in our early live seminars, whatever the sizes of their income, always said they needed more to be happy. We include this exercise in our seminars. We ask people to rate themselves on a happiness scale, 1 miserable to 5 joyous, with 3 being can't complain, and we correlated their ratings with their incomes. In a sample of more than 1,000 people from both the United States and Canada, the average happiness score was consistently between 2.6 and 2.8, not even a 3, whether the person's income was under $1,500 a month or over $6,000 a month. See figure in the included PDF. The results astounded us. They told us that not only are most people habitually unhappy, but they can be unhappy no matter how much money they make. Even people who are doing well financially are not necessarily fulfilled. On those same worksheets, we asked our seminar participants, how much money would it take to make you happy? Can you guess the results? It was always more than I have now, by 50 or 100%. So here we are, the most affluent society that has had the privilege to walk the face of the earth, and we're stuck with our noses to the grindstone, our lives in a perpetual loop between home and job, and our hearts yearning for something that's just over the horizon, or perhaps entirely out of reach. Prosperity and the planet. If this was just a private hell, it would be a tragedy enough. But it's not. Our affluent lifestyles are having increasingly devastating effect on our planet. In 1987, the United Nations World Commission on Environment and Development warned that consumption patterns in the developed world were one of the primary engines of driving global environmental damage. Since that time, however, little in our lifestyles has changed, except better technology to impulse shop. Our failure to change is not from a lack of warning. Some tune out the data entirely, but even if we watch the news, we don't know what to believe anymore or why we should care. Environmentalists have been trying to make the data feel vivid and personal so that we can feel the planet heating the way we feel chilly when the temperature drops. The ecological footprint, a metric distributed by the Global Footprint Network, measures everything we buy, from cars to sofas, in terms of how much of the Earth's resources are embodied in that purchase. You can take a quiz about your consumption and see what your footprint is. Even careful, conscious North Americans would learn that if everyone consumed the way they do, we'd need 4 Earths. Huh, but we only have 1. Every year, in partnership with the World Wildlife Fund, the Global Footprint Network announces Earth Overshoot Day, the annual date when we've collectively used up the resources our planet can renew in a single year before going into ecological debt. In 1971, Earth Overshoot Day fell on December 21st. 10 years later, it was November 12th, then October 11th in 1991. In 2001, it fell on September 23rd. On and on, earlier and earlier. In 2016, it was August 3rd. Check it out. What is it now? The Earth's stores are Mother Nature's cupboard. How long before an essential ingredient in the recipe for life, as we know it, is no longer available? When we go into personal debt, we might lose our car or our house or our ability to borrow at all. But as long as we are alive, we can start filling the coffers again. With ecological debt, that doesn't work. We have only one planet. The biggest loser in the money game. Sadly, many of us are not even aware of this ecological debt because our primary benefactors don't have a voice and we didn't even know we were borrowing from them. We haven't just borrowed from the bank. We've borrowed from future generations and from our very generous planet. Everything we eat, wear, drive, buy, and throw away comes from the Earth. As Annie Leonard vividly shows in her short film, The Story of Stuff, our appetite for things drives a one-way trip for resources, from the earth to factory to store to our house to the dump. We have ignored the fact that we enjoy our current level of affluence by the good and free graces of nature, soil, water, and air, which cost nothing yet are being taxed to the limit. As civilized and advanced as we may have become, we still depend on breathable air, potable water, and fertile soil for our daily existence. No matter how often these facts are repeated, however, we don't seem able to put the brakes on our consumption. Corporations have little incentive to encourage us to consume less. Politically, it's still suicidal to propose consumption-limiting legislation. And personally, until everyone changes, few are willing to sacrifice. The only way green corporations, local governments, and nonprofit organizations have been able to change us at all is to convince us that the three sirens of consumerism, comfort, control, and convenience, are better served by products that demand less from the earth. Once the cost of solar energy became competitive, adoption accelerated. As electric car charging stations become as convenient as gas stations, consumers will adopt this climate-friendlier way of personal transportation. We aren't changing our minds, we're changing our technologies. Is this enough? Not according to Robert Orenstein and Paul Ehrlich. In their book, New World, New Mind, they pointed out that our minds were designed to respond well to short-term threats, tigers and fires and the whites of our enemies' eyes. In today's world, however, piling debts, personal and national, and environmental threats like climate change are building up so slowly that the part of our minds made to respond to harm can't register the danger. We must, Orenstein and Ehrlich contend, learn to react to the early warnings of sophisticated measurements with the same vigor with which we used to climb trees to escape the jaws of a tiger. Some consumers are motivated to change. They look at these ecological trends and become early adopters of green innovations. You may be one of them. But virtue isn't enough to accelerate the pace of change. As you will see, breaking the hold of the more is better myth on your mind means you will change because you want to, not because you have to. You will also gain those status points for being one of the first to adopt what everyone comes to know is the best, smartest, and optimal way to go. You will see clearly that making a dying and having it all are not the only or best ways to make a life, and you will free yourself. Is more better? Many of us are out there making a dying because we've bought into the pervasive consumer myth that more is better. We build our working lives on this myth of more. Our expectation is to make more money as the years go on. We will get greater responsibility and more perks as we move up in our field. Eventually, we hope, we'll have more possessions, more prestige, and more respect from our community. We become habituated to expecting ever more of ourselves, and even more from the world. But rather than satisfaction, our experience is that the more we have, the more we want, and the less content we are with a status quo. In part, the materially expansive frontiers mentality at the heart of the North American psyche explains our obsession with more. Even space on Star Trek was called the final frontier. The West was won, or lost, depending on your point of view, through the political sales pitch of manifest destiny. For Americans, and increasingly for consumers in other nations, this more is better motto leads us to trade in our cars every 3 years, buy new clothes for every event and every season, get a bigger and better house every time we can afford it, and upgrade everything from our TV to our smartphones simply because a new version has been released. All of this stuff isn't just taking a toll on the earth. National Opinion Research Center surveys reveal that the percentage of Americans who describe themselves as very happy, has been steadily declining since the late 1950s. More is better turns out to be a formula for dissatisfaction. If you live for having it all, what you have is never enough. In an environment of more is better, enough is like the horizon, always receding. You lose the ability to identify that point of sufficiency at which you can choose to stop. This is a psychological cul-de-sac, an invisible catch-22 of the consumer myth of more. If more is better, then what I have is not enough. Even when I do get the more I was convinced would make life better, however, I'm still operating on the belief that more is better. So the more I now have still isn't enough. Ah, but hope springs eternal. If I could only get more, then... and on we go. We get deeper in debt and often deeper in despair. The more that was supposed to make life better can never be enough. The limits to growth. Our economy's version of more is better is growth is good. Modern economics worships growth. Growth will solve poverty, the theory goes. Growth will increase our standard of living. Growth will reduce unemployment. Growth will keep us apace with inflation. Growth will relieve the boredom of the rich and the misery of the poor. Growth will bolster the GDP, boost the Dow, and beat our global competitors. A rising tide lifts all boats, right? What we overlook is that all the feedstock for the economic growth comes from nature, and even under the best of circumstances, nature is not infinitely abundant. Resources can and do run out. There are limits to nature. At a physical level, nothing grows forever. Every plant and every animal has a life cycle. Once it reaches an optimal size, it stops growing bigger, investing life energy instead in its survival and reproduction. We also know that every population of plants or animals reaches a maximum number based on the finite resources of energy, food, water, soil, and air, and then begins to stabilize or decrease in size. There always comes a point where the individual or the specific population either collapses or dies off due to lack of resources, or stabilizes at a level that the environment can handle. By ignoring this fundamental reality of the natural world, we as individuals and our economy are now exceeding the Earth's capacity to handle our demands, as Earth Overshoot Day vividly demonstrates. The Cleopatra Explanation. Pam Tillis had it right in her 1993 song with the refrain, "Just call me Cleopatra, everybody, 'cause I'm the queen of denial." For so many people, the stronger the evidence of failed strategies, the deeper they cling to their ways. We don't have to change, we say, because we're sure technology will save us. After all, look at the past. Science and technology have eliminated deadly diseases from smallpox to diphtheria. Surely we'll develop the technology to purify our water, genetically engineer seeds that can grow in extreme environments, clean up pollution, and find the key to unlimited cheap energy. And if technology doesn't save us, surely the government will. Look at our social progress as a species. If we lobby for appropriations, the government will develop a program. There are experts who know what's going on and are handling it for us. Anyway, we conclude, it's not my problem. It's a third world problem. If only they would stop having so many babies and burning their forests, we'd survive. It's they who need to change. In any event, it would be silly for us to change because the reports are probably wrong. Scientists and politicians and the media have lied to us before. The environmental problem is a fabrication of some smart lawyers and nervous Nelly alarmists. And anyway, what can I do? After all, I'm in debt, so I can't stop commuting 40 miles a day to the widget factory, even if the continuation of life on Earth depended on it, which it doesn't, does it? As people and as a planet, we suffer from upward mobility and downward nobility. We need to pause and wonder if it's all worth it, if we're getting the fulfillment we're seeking, and if not, why do we persist like addicts in the habits that are killing us? The creation of consumers. Perhaps we cling to our affluence, even though it isn't working for us or the planet, because of the very nature of our relationship with money. As we shall see, money has become the movie screen on which our lives play out. We project onto money the capacity to fulfill our fantasies, allay our fears, soothe our pain, and send us soaring to new heights. In fact, we now meet most of our needs, wants, and desires through money. We buy everything from hope to happiness. We no longer live life, we consume it. People in industrialized nations used to be called citizens. Now we are consumers, which means, according to the dictionary definition of consume, people who use up, waste, destroy, and squander. Consumerism, however, is just a 20th century invention of our industrial society, created at a time when encouraging people to buy more goods was seen as necessary for continued economic growth. By the early 1920s, once we were starting to win the Industrial Revolution, a curious wrinkle had emerged. The astounding capacity of machinery to fill human needs had been so successful that economic activity was slowing down. Instinctively knowing they had enough, American workers were asking for a shorter work week and more leisure to enjoy the fruits of their labor. Two sectors of American society were alarmed at this trend. The moralists, who had internalized the Protestant work ethic, believed that idle hands do the devil's work. Leisure is debasing, they thought, leading us at least to sloth, if not to the rest of the seven deadly sins. Industrialists also sounded the alarm. Reduced demand for factory output threatened to halt economic growth. Workers did not seem as instinctively eager to buy new goods and services like cars, appliances, and entertainment, as they did the old ones, like food, clothing, and shelter. The alternative to growth, however, was seen not as maturity, but as the precursor to stagnation of civilization and the death of productivity. New markets were needed for the expanding cornucopia of goods that machines could turn out with such speed and precision, and for the continued profit of the industrialists. And here's the stroke of genius. These new markets would consist of the same populace, but the people would need to be educated to want not only what they needed, but also new things that they didn't need. Enter the concept of, quote-unquote, standard of living. The new art, science, and industry dubbed marketing was born to convince Americans that they were working to elevate their standard of living rather than to satisfy basic economic needs. In 1929, Herbert Hoover's Committee on Recent Economic Changes published a progress report on this new, and very welcome, he believed, strategy. The survey has proved conclusively what has long been held theoretically to be true, that wants are almost insatiable, that one want satisfied makes way for another. The conclusion is that economically we have a boundless field before us, that there are new wants which will make way endlessly for newer wants as fast as they are satisfied. Our situation is fortunate. Our momentum is remarkable. Instead of leisure being simply relaxed activity, it was transformed into an opportunity for increased consumption. Even consumption of leisure itself, as in travel and vacations. Henry Ford concurred. Where people work less, they buy more. Business is the exchange of goods. Goods are bought only as they meet needs. Needs are filled only as they are felt. They make themselves felt largely in the leisure hours. The Hoover Commission agreed. Leisure was not, in fact, an excuse to relax. It was a hole to fill with more wants, which in turn required more work to pay for them. Somehow, the consumer solution satisfied both the industrial hedonists hell-bent on achieving material paradise and the Puritans, who feared that unoccupied leisure would lead to sin. In fact, the new consumerism promoted all the deadly sins, lust, covetousness, gluttony, pride, envy, except perhaps anger and sloth. Only temporarily subdued by the Depression, consumerism returned with an added vigor in the post-World War II era. In 1955, U.S. retailing analyst Victor Lebeau observed, "Our enormously productive economy demands that we make consumption our way of life, that we convert the buying and use of goods into rituals, that we seek our spiritual satisfaction, our ego satisfaction, in consumption. We need things consumed, burned up, worn out, replaced, and discarded at an ever-increasing rate." And thus, the rat race was born, leading to our excruciating balancing act between working more to buy more luxuries, to have enough leisure to enjoy them. Today, that has taken on added dimension. With the intrusion of the internet and smartphones into every waking moment of our lives, we can be consumers wherever and whenever, from desire to delivery. Almost anything we want is only a few swipes, taps, or clicks away. What was once a privilege for the few now seems like a right for the masses. In our initial enthusiasm for our new status as consumers, we learned to assert our rights, standing up to unscrupulous business. Rights, however, have since taken on a different hue. The right to buy. Americans have come to believe deeply that it is our right to consume. If we have the money, we can buy whatever we want, whether or not we need it, use it, or even enjoy it. After all, it's a free country. And if we don't have the money, heck, what are credit cards for? Born to shop. Whoever dies with the most toys wins. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of material possessions. Not only have we absorbed the notion that it is right to buy, but we believe consuming is what keeps America strong. If we don't consume, we're told, masses of people will be thrown out of work. Families will lose their homes. Unemployment will rise. Factories will be shut down. Whole towns will lose their economic base. We have to buy gadgets to keep America strong. Why else would the Consumer Confidence Index be a benchmark for America's continued dominance? Part of why our consumers have less money to spend is that saving has clearly become un-American. Even the language of modern economics promotes consumption. What else would we do with our disposable income besides dispose of it? We certainly wouldn't want to keep it around where it would just rot. So if consuming is the way to keep our economy strong, and savers are people willing to put their fellow citizens out of work, an online shopping spree can be considered downright patriotic. The only downside is that our rising expectations have outstripped our incomes, leaving the average consumer patriot increasingly in debt. This puts us in a bind. The only way for us to exercise our economic patriotism is to go deeper into debt. We are in a no-win situation. You're wrong if you buy, and wrong if you don't. All of this is exacerbated by advertising. The average American child aged 2 to 11 sees more than 25,000 advertisements a year. Globally, advertising spending is well over $500 billion. These ads influencing our wants and desires used to be confined to TV, print media, and billboards. But in the digital age, they follow us everywhere. As Americans spend increasing amounts of time on their mobile devices, pop-ups, Flashing banners and sidebar ads are there to greet us, reminding us of past browser searches and online purchases. Marketing theory says that people are driven by fear, by the promise of exclusivity, by guilt and greed, and by the need for approval. Advertising technology, armed with market research and sophisticated psychology, aims to throw us off balance emotionally and then promises to resolve our discomfort with a product. At the same time, television, phone, radio, internet, and newspaper ads are reporting the bad news about the environment. Product packaging is clogging the landfills. Product manufacturing is contributing to climate change, polluting the groundwater, deforesting the Amazon, fouling the rivers, and lowering the water table. If I wear clothes made from conventionally grown cotton, I'm encouraging massive pesticide use. If I wear synthetic fabrics, I use fossil fuels. If I wear nothing, I'm putting people out of work. It's damned if we do and damned if we don't. It seems there is no way consumers can be right. Everything we do exacts a cost from the environment. Even new, eco-friendly, or sustainable products are only comparatively less stressful to the earth and by no means benign. Clearly, we don't think about this as we're headed to work in the morning. We don't ponder to consume or not to consume. That is the question. The notion that it's right to consume daily bumps into the admonition that we're deep in debt personally and playing Russian roulette with the environment to boot. How, in the midst of our busy lives, can we become more aware of, much less do something about, the enormous problems we're facing? What can one person do, we ask, and then change stations on the radio? And so we continue making a stab at changing one week, binging the next, and depending on denial to shield us from the tough choices ahead. If we continue to rely on making small, token changes, however, we will merely slow our headlong rush toward a diminished and impoverished future. What's needed isn't change, it's transformation. Change seeks different solutions to intractable problems. Transformation asks different questions so that we can see the problems in a new light. We need to shift from an ethic of growth to an ethic of sustainability, which will certainly require each one of us to transform our relationship with money and the material world. Reevaluating our earning and spending activity could put our lives, our society, and the global commons back on track. We need to learn from our past, determine our present reality, and create a new reality-based relationship with money, discarding assumptions and myths that don't work. We need a new roadmap for money and materialism, one that is truly in tune with the times. The beginning of a new roadmap for money. What makes consuming so all-consuming? While the advertising industry may have conspired to sell us on materialism, the fact is, we bought it. Why? Psychologists call money the last taboo. It's easier to tell our therapist about our sex life than it is to tell an accountant about our finances. Money, not necessarily how much we have, but how we feel about it, governs our lives as much or more than any other factor. Aside from complaining or gossiping, money is a legitimate and interesting topic, just doesn't come up between friends or even between partners. Why not? What do we stand to lose by having an honest talk about money? Patterns of belief. To begin to understand this, we need to understand a bit about the human mind. Numerous sources, from modern brain researchers to ancient Eastern philosophers, seem to agree on the basic notion that the mind is a pattern-making and pattern-repeating device. Rather than having a fixed behavioral response for every stimulus, as some animals do, humans tend to create patterns of responses. Some come from personal experience, primarily in the first 5 years of life. Some are genetic. Some are cultural. Some seem to be universal. All of them are there, presumably, to increase our chances of survival. Once a pattern is recorded, once it's been tested and deemed useful for survival, it becomes very hard to change. We salivate to the smell of sauteing onions, step on the brakes at the sight of a red light, and pump adrenaline when somebody yells, "Fire!" Clearly, we couldn't survive if we didn't have these huge libraries of interpretations coupled with behaviors. But here's the problem. Not all of these patterns have anything to do with objective reality, yet they persist, governing our behavior. They are so tenacious, in fact, that we will often ignore or deny reality itself in favor of one of our interpretations. Does walking under a ladder or breaking a mirror really bring bad luck? Most of us are beyond such primitive superstitions. But what about other, less suspect beliefs? How do we catch a cold? By going outdoors with a wet head? By being exposed to germs? The former we recognize as an old wives' tale, but the latter? After all, there are people who don't get the cold going around the office. Did the germs skip them? Could the germ theory be just a modern superstition? Which of our beliefs will look quaint to future generations? What do our actions say? Is it possible that some of our financial beliefs are no more reality-based than the flat earth theory? Could that be true? What does our financial behavior reveal about our superstitions? Are we willing to outgrow these the way we outgrew the conviction that there were monsters under our childhood beds? For example, while we might vigorously maintain that we know money can't buy happiness and the best things in life are free, honesty requires that we look deeper. Our behavior tells a different story. What do we do when we're depressed, when we are lonely, when we feel unloved? More often than not, we buy something to make us feel better. A new outfit, a drink, or two, a new car, an ice cream cone, a trip to Hawaii, a goldfish, a ticket to the movies, a bag of Oreos, or two. When we want to celebrate good fortune, we buy something, a round of drinks, a catered wedding, a bouquet of roses, a diamond ring. When we're bored, we buy something, a magazine, a cruise, a mobile app, a bet on the horses. When we think there must be more to life, we buy something, a workshop, a self-help book, a house in the country, a condo in the city. None of this is wrong. It's just what we do. We have learned to seek external solutions to signals from the mind, heart, or soul that something is out of balance. We try to satisfy essentially psychological and spiritual needs with consumption at a physical level. How did this happen? Look in your PDF for figure 1.2, the fulfillment curve, enough. The fulfillment curve. The fulfillment curve shows the relationship between the experience of fulfillment and the amount of money we spend, usually to acquire more possessions. In the beginning of our lives, more possessions did indeed mean more fulfillment. Basic needs were met. We were fed. We were warm. We were sheltered. Most of us don't remember the fear of cold and hunger that was remedied by just a blanket and a breast, but we all went through it. When we were uncomfortable, when we cried, something came from the outside to take care of us. It seemed like magic. Our needs were filled. We survived. Our minds recorded such incidents and remembered. Have a need? Let that mysterious, magic, need-fulfilling machine know what you need. Cry. Cry louder. Grab. Wave your hand. Ask if you have words. Whatever works. And it will deliver it. And you will return to happiness. Need, look outside yourself, get stuff, get fulfillment. We then went on from bare necessities, food, clothing, shelter, to some niceties, toys, a wardrobe, a bicycle. And the positive relationship between new things and fulfillment became even more deeply embedded. Remember your excitement as a child when you got a toy you'd been dying for. If our parents were being responsible, they soon taught us, those things cost money, dear, money that we had to go out and earn for you because we love you. Ah, new rule. Need, look outside yourself, get money, get stuff, get fulfillment. We got an allowance to learn the value of money. We could select and purchase happiness ourselves. And so it went, year after year. Eventually, we slipped beyond niceties to outright luxuries and hardly recognized the change. A car, for example, is a luxury that the vast majority of the world's population never enjoys. For us, however, our first car is the beginning of a lifelong love affair with the automobile. Then there's the luxury of our first trip away from home or going away to college, our first apartment. Notice that while each one is still a thrill, it costs more per thrill, and the high wore off more quickly. But by then, we believed that money equals fulfillment, so we barely noticed that the curve had started to level out. On we went into life. House, job, family responsibilities. More money brought more worry, more time and energy commitments as we rose the corporate ladder. More time away from the family. More to lose if we were robbed. So more worry about being robbed. More taxes and more tax accountants' fees. More demand from community charities. Remodeling bills, internet, TV, and phone bills. Just keeping the kids happy bills. Until one day we found ourselves sitting, unfulfilled, in our big home on 2.5 wooded acres with a 3-car garage and expensive exercise equipment in the basement, yearning for the life we had as a poor college student who could find joy in a walk in the park. We hit a fulfillment ceiling and never recognized that the formula of money equals fulfillment not only had stopped working, but it started to work against us. No matter how much we bought, the fulfillment curve kept heading down. Enough, the peak of the curve. There's a very interesting place on this graph. It's the peak. Part of the secret of life, it would seem, comes from identifying for yourself that point of maximum fulfillment. There is a name for this peak of the fulfillment curve, and it provides the basis for transforming your relationship with money. It's a word we use every day, yet we are practically incapable of recognizing it when it's staring us in the face. The word is enough. At the peak of the fulfillment curve, we have enough. Enough necessities for our survival, enough niceties for our comforts and pleasures, and even a little luxuries. We have everything we need. There's nothing extra to weigh us down, distract, or distress us. Nothing we've bought on credit and have never used and are slaving to pay off. Enough is a fearless place, a trusting place, an honest and self-observant place. It's appreciating and fully enjoying what money brings into your life, and yet never purchasing anything that isn't needed and wanted. Once you have discovered what is enough for you, your fulfillment curve can reverse direction and head straight up. Stay tuned. Clutter, a fate worse than dearth. So what's all that stuff beyond enough, beyond the peak, where the fulfillment curve begins to go down? Clutter, that's what it is. Clutter is anything that is excess for you. It's whatever you have that doesn't serve you, yet takes up space in your world. To let go of clutter, then, is not dearth or lack. It's lightening up and opening up space for something new to happen. As self-evident as these ideas may be, many people experience a subtle, or not so subtle, resistance to letting them in. This is why downscaling frugality and thrift sound like deprivation, lack, and need. On the contrary, enough is a very wide and stable plateau. It's a place of alertness, creativity, and freedom. From this place, being suffocated under a mountain of clutter that must be stored, cleaned, gotten rid of, and paid for on time is indeed a fate worse than dearth. Stations of the Crass. What creates clutter? The fulfillment curve strongly suggests that most clutter enters our lives through the more is better door. It comes from the disease of materialism, of looking for inner fulfillment in outer possessions. It comes from the early programming that discomfort can be alleviated by something external, a baby bottle, a blanket, a bicycle, a BA, a BMW, or eventually another kind of bottle. It also comes from unconscious habit. Take Gazingus pins. A Gazingus pin is any item that you just can't pass by without buying. Everybody has them. They run the gamut from earbuds and tiny screwdrivers to shoes, pens, chocolate kisses. So there you are in the mall or online, a shopping robot on your weekly tour of the stations of the Crass. You come to the Gazingus pin section and your mind starts cranking out Gazingus pin thoughts. Oh, there's a pink one. I don't have a pink one. Oh, that one is wireless. That would be handy. My, a waterproof one. If I don't use it, I can always give it away. Yum, this one has hazelnuts in it and coconut and amaretto. Never had one of those before. And before you know it, an alien arm attached to your body has reached out, picked up, or clicked on the Gazingus pin, and off you go to the checkout, still functioning like a wind-up zombie. You arrive home with your purchase, or it arrives on your doorstep, and you put it in the Gazingus pin drawer, where there are already 5 or 10 others. And you forget about Gazingus pins until your next shopping trip, at which point you come to the Gazingus pins section and... Faces and functions of clutter. Just because something is out of sight doesn't mean it isn't clutter. Our various Gazingus pin drawers, including our attics, basements, garages, closets, and storage sheds, are havens of clutter, filled with projects we'll never finish and products we'll probably never use. Ignoring them can fill you with shame. Sorting through them can fill you with guilt. Clothing bagged for the thrift store after a few wearings leaves a vague feeling of dissatisfaction and superficiality, not to mention to adding to the landfill. Once you catch on to what clutter is, you'll find it everywhere. Isn't meaningless activity a form of clutter? How many of the power lunches, cocktail parties, social events, and long evenings glued to your screen have been clutter, activities that add nothing positive to your life? What about disorganized days full of busyness and no sense of accomplishment? And what about tasks on your to-do list that never get done? Stumbling over them, week in, week out, on your list, is like the frustration of navigating the perennial magazines and kids' toys that litter some people's living rooms. There are cluttered motives, such as when we are aware of many minds about everything from public policy to personal decisions. Unplanned errands are often time clutter, running to the store twice a day for items forgotten on your weekly shopping trip. Hobbies are clutter, intensive when the ratio of what you have to what you use climbs, like the photography buffs with suitcases full of lenses and filters who actually get their best shots with a smartphone. All of that is clutter, elements in your environment that don't serve you yet take up space. As your awareness of clutter deepens, you will be inspired to spring clean your whole life. The urge to purge, in fact, runs deep in the American psyche as well. From the Puritans to Thoreau, the Quakers, and authors like Duane Elgin and Cecile Andrews, simple living has arisen again and again to balance the excesses of our capitalist system. Now it's called minimalism, or tidying up. We call it enough because there is no particular specific thing that is enough, which means it's up to you. It's not less is more. It's not one perfect daisy in a vase on a spotless dresser with sun pouring through the window. It's not torn jeans or a little black dress. It's not that one perfect chef's knife alone in the drawer. It's the Goldilocks feeling of just rightness you recognize as you approach having enough of everything you want and need, but nothing in excess. Everyone's enough looks different. One person's treasure is another person's trash. As you follow the 9 steps outlined in this book, you will develop your own personal definition of clutter and will slowly, painlessly, even joyfully rid yourself of it. The first step will be to ask, how did it all get here? And what is it worth to me now, really? Just as some students learn how much they throw away by having to carry their garbage around in a sack for a week, you will start to look at your relationship with stuff by looking at all you've accumulated, all you've earned, all you've spent, and how much of your life energy you've wasted. Step 1. Making peace with the past. Are you ready to survey your own relationship with money and the things that money can buy? The purpose of this exercise is to increase your awareness, not your arrogance or your shame. It helps you to locate yourself in time and space. To review, without blame, your earning and spending activity in the past. A caveat before we continue. Stop. Read this. It's important. While this is step 1 of the FI program, you don't have to do it first, and you don't have to stop reading until you do it. You need to do it eventually, but you could start with step 2 and come back to this step later. In fact, we suggest that you listen to this whole book first rather than doing each step as it comes up. Then come back and get started. There are 2 parts to this step. A. Find out how much money you have earned in your lifetime, the sum total of your gross income, from the first penny you've ever earned to your most recent paycheck. B. Find out your net worth by creating a personal balance sheet of assets and liabilities. A. How much have you earned in your life? Initially, this task may seem impossible. I haven't kept track, you may protest. However, a little bit of archaeology pays off. First, dig out your copies of old income tax returns. Adjust the figures to reflect any cheating you did, tips you didn't report, jobs that paid you under the table, informal consulting, gambling winnings, gifts from relatives that were unreported, any money you've stolen, cash prizes you've won, rent collected from the extra room in your house or the extra house you never use, and all other unreported income. Go down memory lane to those summer jobs you had during high school and college, and all the twists and turns of your own financial meandering through early adulthood and beyond. Spend a few days with whatever financial records you may have stashed away, old bank statements, old paychecks, and abandoned account books. Too young for all that paper? Get your online records from your bank. If you have a resume, use it as an outline for year-by-year job history. Tell the truth about those 3 years you glossed over as further career training. What odd jobs did you have, and how much did you earn picking apples, house-sitting, or lifeguarding? If you live in the United States and have been a salaried employee your entire working life, the Social Security Administration has also kept a record. Contact your local or state office or the national one and apply for a Social Security statement which details your lifetime earnings. If you're having a tough time hunting down the specifics, estimate as best you can. The object is to get as accurate and honest a figure as possible for the total amount of money that has entered your life. The value of step 1. This step is useful in several ways. It clears the fog shrouding your past relationship with money. Most people have no idea how much money has entered their lives, and therefore no idea how much money could enter their lives. 2, it eradicates such myths and false self-concepts as, I can't earn very much money, and even, I don't have to worry, I can always earn a lot of money, often said by individuals being supported by somebody else. If you are one of many who grossly underestimate how much money has entered your life, this step can be amazingly powerful. You are worth more than you thought in dollars and cents and possibly other ways too. 3, it gets you to ground zero, enabling you to begin the financial program with a clear head and confidence in your wage-earning ability. 4, it allows you to see and let go of any skeletons from the past that you may have in your closet, any secrets or lies that may be distorting your current relationship with money. A story about a divorced woman in her mid-30s who had attended one of our seminars illustrates the power of this step. She had been a suburban housewife most of her life, afflicted with the mental malady that often accompanies this profession. She had an image of herself as dependent, unworldly, and, if the truth be known, unworthy. She knew this step didn't apply to her. After all, she had made no financial contribution to her marriage and was, to that day, ashamed of accepting the divorce settlement money, money she felt she hadn't earned. But after digging into her past, she learned that she had earned more than $50,000 from assorted odd jobs during those years of her marriage when she was contributing nothing. For the first time, she saw herself as a competent wage earner. Merely doing this step gave her the confidence to apply for and land a job at twice the salary she had previously assumed she could get. Similarly, if you're on your first full-time job, you may find confidence in learning how much you've earned from various jobs in the early years of your life. Internships, summer jobs, and freelance work all add up over time. Useful attitudes. No shame, no blame. This step may bring feelings of self-criticism, even shame, to the surface. Here's a way to work through those gently. A valuable exercise that helps people thoroughly change their minds and learn to think in new ways. Some people call it by its Sanskrit name, mantra. But it's really any simple word or phrase that embodies a particular attitude or attribute you want to focus on. A mantra is like a rudder, something that allows you to steer your mind away from danger and toward a clear, open horizon. A useful mantra for following this financial program is, no shame, no blame. In the choice to change unwanted behavior, there is a difference between recrimination and discrimination. Recrimination is about shame and blame, good and evil, while discrimination sorts out the true from the false. Sinking into blame and shame slows your progress toward financial freedom. Recrimination immobilizes, demoralizes, and distracts you. Discrimination, however, simply shines a bright light on potential pitfalls so that you can skirt them. You may stumble repeatedly over the desire to blame yourself or other people based on what you learn by following this program. At those times, remember discrimination and remember the mantra, no shame, no blame. Your lifetime earnings represent just a number, not your value. It is neither too much nor too little. It doesn't prove your worth nor your unworthiness. It is justification neither for despair because none of your money is left, nor for gloating because your friend earns so much less. Any financial mistakes you've made and pain they've caused you another can melt in the warmth of no shame, no blame. Impeccability. Since accuracy and accountability are called for in every step of the program, starting out with these two qualities sets a good example for you to live up to. When you do this step and the others in this book, set your sights on impeccability. Have you really searched your files and your memory banks for all your income? Yes, you could settle for close enough answer, but we suggest that you go for full frontal integrity, since the power of this program increases with every ounce of honesty and integrity you invest in it. Rounding to the dollar takes a lot of soul and paycheck stub searching. Rounding to the nearest 100 is looser, but over a lifetime, that might be plenty accurate. Don't stress over this step. Just do the best job you can. It's worth your time. Checklist. 1. Statement of earnings from Social Security. 2. Income tax returns. 3. Checkbook records. 4. old and current statements. 5. Gifts. 6. Winnings. 7. Loans. 8. Capital gains. 9. Illegal sources.